appreciate our worship team, don't we? So Hebrews 11:22 and Genesis from about chapter 37 to the end is all about Joseph. I wonder, have you thought about what your last words on planet Earth might be that are recorded? You know, the last thing he said was, the last statement I heard from her was, I doubt seriously that most of us have thought about trying to leave a statement to be read at our memorial, and the last thing that he said was, don't leave my bones here, take them with you. That's Joseph. By faith, 11:22 of Hebrews, by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. And in Genesis 50 at verse 25, just before he died, at least the record of his death, then Joseph made the sons of Israel promise or swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. We're seeing a pattern in the faith heroes of chapter 11 that regardless of how major life experience they had and how much we can learn from them, their faith and their focus and their positive things and their negative things, and we learn from all of it, the Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews, has a penetrating theme of, as their statements are made about these men, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and today Joseph, and the pattern continues, that they were looking ahead. And we know that they were anticipating the fulfillment of a promise that God had made to the Jewish nation. And so it's very appropriate. When Jacob died, Joseph's father, he wanted to have them take him and bury him back in his land, in the land of Israel. They're living in Egypt at the time. And so Joseph and a big a group of people with the approval of Pharaoh took Jacob and buried him back in his homeland. When Joseph died, he follows the same theme. And he says, when you go to the land where you belong, our people, the Israelites, take my bones. Now, I find a mystery in all of this, and my mind goes a little crazy when I try to put this all together, because the last two verses of Genesis are what we're just reading. He made this request, and then he died at the age of 110. All right, that's Joseph. Next page, Exodus, chapter 1, verse 1. But you have to remember that between those two books is a time span of over 400 years. 400 years. Can you think back 400 years? And during those 400 years, more like 430, I think, the Israelites, the descendants of Abraham, who under Jacob's leadership moved to Egypt, numbering 70, and then Joseph finishes his life, and you fast forward to Exodus 1:1, and probably the nation Israel had multiplied maybe to several million people. We know that there were at least 600 men who were past 20 years of age that were able to be military. And then you add their wife and their kids, and then the older. And many people believe that there might have been 2 or 3 million people who were the workforce of Egypt when God sent Moses down there to lead them out of Egypt finally and to the promised land. Okay? So over 400 years later, massive people, Pharaoh doesn't want them to go. Moses says, we're going to go. And finally, Pharaoh is so upset with the plagues that are happening and the death that hit. And he says, get out of town. And they go out in mass, headed towards the promised land. They're going to go down and cross the Red Sea miraculously. Oh, and by the way, they carried Joseph's bones. How did they pull that off? Where were they? They embalmed Joseph and put him in a coffin in Egypt. That's as much as we know in Genesis. And it says in Exodus, at the Exodus, when they made this massive departure in this huge number of people, that they carried Joseph's bones. Now, I just find that really fascinating. Not so much that they packed these bones, but that they knew to do that and that God made sure it happened. Isn't that exciting? I mean, that's a detail that would be easy to overlook. Joseph did not want to be left permanently in Egypt because he believed the promise of God that his nation, his people, would be in their land. And eventually they were. And then over the course of years, they've basically lost it. And today there's not much spiritual activity going on among the Jewish nation. But I believe, according to Revelation and prophecies that Jesus made, that the day will come when the complete fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 will be there. And the Jews, with Jesus as their king, will live in their land for a time. And that's very exciting to me to think about that. These guys were forward thinking. So in your notes, it says Joseph's legacy of faith is a pattern that anyone who follows Jesus wants to enjoy. There's only a few people in the Bible that I think the record of, I know they were all human. All of the humans were human, and Joseph was as human as the next one. But there's only a few of them that live a life that sounds almost perfect. Daniel is one of those. As far as I know, there's nothing recorded in the Bible about Daniel that's negative. You know, you've got great people like David and Solomon and Moses and Abraham, but they all have a record of something really stupid that they did and sins that they committed. You don't find that on Daniel. And you have to look for it to find it on Joseph. And I won't take anything away from him if you have this really lily-white image of him. But I think there's a little bit in his early days that maybe indicate that he was a typical kid. But he comes close. And that's why I titled this Joseph Always Confident. And he makes a great hero for any of us to follow and to learn from his life because he did so many things so right. Who wants to be a favored son? Genesis 37:3. We touched on this with his dad, Jacob. Joseph was the son of Rachel along with Benjamin, the favored wife of Jacob. And he became a favorite son. And we've talked about the fact that favoritism in a home always brings conflict, and it obviously did here. When you read those early statements about Joseph and that he pastured his father's flock and that he brought a bad report back from the brothers, maybe it's the favored son. Maybe it's the one that dad was always thinking ways to honor him. Maybe he was kind of a tattletale. I can see that happening. Not saying he was, just wondering. And then dad comes along and he honors Joseph by making him this beautiful coat. The front of your worship folder today is multicolored. I think it makes a statement about Joseph's multicolored, beautiful coat. And obviously there were things developing in the relationships of the siblings under Jacob's leadership or lack of that made Joseph an object for the brothers to hate. And they did. They despised him. He got them in trouble when he brought a bad report. And when he showed up with his coat, they knew that he was favored and they really wanted to get rid of him. In chapter 37, starting at verse 18, is the story of when, and I don't know why his dad did this. Surely Jacob knew that there was conflict among the brothers. Surely he wasn't so out to lunch that he didn't realize that the boys hated Joseph. So why he put this lovely coat on him and sent him out through the prairies to check on the brothers, why would he do that? Why did Jacob do a lot of things that he did? why does Pastor Bill do a lot of the stupid things that he does? And I look back on it and I say, why did I do that? And I think that's what Jacob probably said about himself. But he sent him out and he finally found the brothers and they saw him coming and they said, here's our chance. And so they first wanted to, they had a variety of ways that they would want to deal with him. Reuben tried to protect him. And you remember that they threw him into a pit. And then some Midianites and Ishmaelites on a caravan going to Egypt pulled up Joseph out of the pit, sold him, made some money off him. There's a beautiful connection between that, the pieces of silver that they paid for him and Jesus being sold for pieces of silver. And Joseph is on his way to Egypt. And then the brothers, they have to do something. So they take the coat and they mess it up and they put blood on it and they send it back to Dad. Dad looks at it. His heart is broken. He says, surely a wild animal has killed my son and I'll go to my grave in bereavement. Very interesting in that story to show the hardness of those brothers' hearts, because during the time that they were plotting and putting Joseph in the pit and this whole thing was going on, it specifically records that they sat down and had lunch. When you can be in the middle of a hatred, murderous attitude and sit down and have lunch, you have a hard heart. And it chills me when I read that. So Joseph arrives in Egypt and he becomes a part of the workforce of a high up official in Egypt, Potiphar, and is a worker in his house. And God blesses him, and Potiphar realizes that Joseph has something special going for him. I have no idea if he recognized anything about Joseph's God or what it was, but he knew he had a good man, and he liked what he did, and he put him in charge of everything, and Joseph ran the show. And all Potiphar thought about was his next meal, and I'm sure that was provided in great form. Number three, I put how to be faithful when tempted, and I think this is one of the most powerful lessons from Joseph's life. If you look at chapter 39 at verse 7, Joseph's going about his work. And in verse 7 of 39, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and she said, lie with me. She hits on him and she wants him to go to bed with her. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me around, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. And here's the key line into verse 9. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? When we're being tempted to do something evil, to sin, whatever it is, if we'll stop and realize that it's not just against ourselves, it's not just against another person, it's against God, a sin against God, it probably will make a difference in how we respond. Verse 10, and it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day that he did not listen to her, to lie beside her, or even be with her. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. Now there's a lot of people today that are running from things that we shouldn't run from. We should face our past. We should face our failures. We should face situations that need to be corrected. But when we're in a situation where we're being tempted to sin, we should run. Just run. That's what Joseph did. If we get a glance at pornography, instead of looking a second time, we should run. If we're being in a journey that's leading us into an addictive behavior of alcohol or drugs, we should run. If we're inclined to become greedy, if we're inclined to become selfish, if we're inclined to get involved in a relationship that we know would not proper, we need to follow the attitude and the actions of Joseph and run. It's the best advice I think we can give to anybody. When we're tempted to sin, We need to remember that the sin would be against God and turn and run regardless of the consequences. And he got a negative consequence temporarily. You remember, she's jilted now. She's sad. She didn't get what she wanted. But she's got his coat. She grabbed hold of it, and somehow she hung on to it, and he ran away without it. And so she hangs on to it, and she mopes until her husband comes home. And she tells the guys in the house, and then she tells her husband that Joseph attacked her. He assaulted her. He tried to mess with her. And, of course, her husband is ticked off about that. And he sends his best worker to jail. And so Joseph goes to jail for doing the right thing. Doesn't seem like it feels very good that he did the right thing and ended up in jail. But it's a temporary thing. And remember when he was there, Joseph's life is about dreams. He had dreams when he was a kid still at home. That was part of the hatred. The dreams about the stalks of grain that bowed down to him, and the dreams about the sun, moon, and stars. And that even shook his dad up a little bit. And now he's in prison, and he's going to be dealing with a couple of guys that had dreams. As near as I can tell, in chapter 40, when he's in prison, he's about 30 years young at that point. He was 17 when he went into Egypt. And you remember the Pharaoh had two real key guys. One was the butler that tasted his wine, and one was the baker that fixed his food, and something went bad, and both of them got sent to prison. And then one night they had a dream. They each had a dream, and they came to Joseph with their dreams, and Joseph interpreted them. And it turned out really good for the butler. He got to go back to work. And it turned out not so good for the baker. He got killed and the birds ate him. But the dreams came true. And Joseph says to the butler, you're going to get restored to your job. And would you do this? Would you remind the important people up there that I'm in prison not for doing something wrong? Would you let them know? And there's that famous statement that the butler got his job back, but then he forgot all about Joseph. What a reminder. When somebody does a favor for us, the least we can do is remember him, right? I so like the old King James Version that says the butler forgot all about him. Yep. And then eventually, the Pharaoh, he has a dream, and it's about the good ears of corn gobbling up the bad ones, and the skinny cows eating up the good ones, and he's all troubled by what this means. Dreams mean everything to people back in those days. God communicated through dreams. And finally, as the butler's boss is really upset about what to do, the butler says, by the way, I should have said this a long time ago. There's a guy down in jail that interprets dreams. Maybe he could help you out. Sure enough, they bring Joseph up to clean him up, shave him up, and he goes into the Pharaoh, and he interprets the dreams. Pharaoh's impressed. He finds out that there's going to be 7 good years and 7 famine years. He puts Joseph in charge of everything, and Joseph becomes the number 2 guy, second only to the Pharaoh. Can you believe this? This kid that was running around with a coat and hated by his brothers, and then goes down and is faithful, and then ends up in jail. And where is he now? He's the number 2 guy in the land of Egypt. Does God get his work done? Because God needs somebody down there in charge in Egypt that can keep the Israelites alive. Otherwise, they'll starve to death and the promise won't be fulfilled. Amazing story. So that all took place. And over the next period of time, you remember that Joseph does what he said he would do. And he fills all the granaries with 7 years of wonderful harvest. And then the drought begins and people run out of food. And so they come and they get it from Joseph. And then when they run out of money, he takes their property. And, you know, Egypt becomes pretty much in charge of everything. And in the course of this, down in Israel, down in Canaan, Jacob and the other 11 boys, the rest of the family, and they're going to starve to death. And God's promise to Abraham is going to die. Because there won't be anybody to fulfill it. Except Joseph is in Egypt. And there's food there. And so Jacob, he's a smart guy, says, hey, boys, go down to Egypt and get some food, buy some food. They had money, they just didn't have any food. And you remember the story about Joseph recognized them, but they didn't recognize Joseph. I think it's one of the most fascinating stories in the Bible. It's another part of me that wonders if Joseph, in all of his wonderful holiness, if he wasn't just a little bit ornery too, maybe. He plays games with these guys. He knows them. He says things to them. He quizzes them. He's finding out whether they really are honest. And they end up telling him everything. You know, we've got a dad, and there's 11 of us, and there was 12, but one of them isn't anymore. And the youngest boy's down with dad because he won't let him go anywhere. I mean, they just spill it all out. And Joseph plays this little game. He sells them their grain, and then he puts the money back in the sacks. And when they get home, they've got all their money, and that makes them all nervous. But he said, you're going to need to come back because the famine is severe. And when you come back, the only way I'll get you some more food is if you bring your youngest brother. Oh, my. And you see a side of Jacob. Fast forward a little time when it's time to go back and get some more food. And they say, we can't go down there without Benjamin. And you see a side of Jacob that's that ongoing kind of a deceit attitude that he had, such a deceiver. And he says, you can't take him. And they said, we won't go without him. And finally, Jacob says, why did you have to tell him that I even had a youngest son? Why did you have to tell him? Think of how the story would be different if they hadn't told it. Because Joseph would have known they were dishonest. Poor old Jacob. When he talked to Pharaoh when he moved down to Egypt, he said, I've only lived 136 and few and painful have been my years. And a lot of his pain was because he was deceitful. So anyway, Joseph's got this thing. So finally, you know, Jacob's hungry and the only way to get food is to send Benjamin. And one of the brothers says, you know, if I don't bring him back, you can kill my sons and whatever. They make all kinds of vows. And they go down and Joseph sees them and he sees Benjamin and he's so overcome with emotion that he goes off in the room and cries and finally gets himself together and goes back out. And then he invites them into this meal and he sets them up at the table and he sets them up in the order of their ages from the eldest to the youngest. And they're looking at each other saying, how can this happen? And then he gives Benjamin more food than the rest of them. And then he lets them go. And he has them put his silver cup in Benjamin's bag. That kind of ornery. I think he must have just been thinking, you know, and I'm sure it was holy. I'm sure he wasn't sinning. But don't you think he was enjoying that a little bit? Don't you get a little satisfaction when you see somebody who did something so wrong finally get caught and you're in a spot to maybe egg this thing along? I don't know. You wouldn't do that, but I would. So they take off, and as soon as they're down the road a little ways, Joseph sends his guys after them, and he says, get them and go through their bags and tell them, why would you do such a thing? Steal the important man's silver cup, whosever bag it's in, bring him back. He'll be mine. And they find it in Benjamin's bag. And the boys are mortified and they don't know what to do. And so they all go back. And finally, Joseph reveals to them who he is. And he says, you think the famine is bad now? It's going to get a whole lot worse. So we're going to move all of you to Egypt so that you'll survive. And they send wagons down. And when they tell Jacob, when they get home and they tell Jacob that his son Joseph is alive, he can't believe it. But when he sees all the wagons and everything, he's overcome with emotion. And he says, I'm going to get to see my Joseph after all before I die. And they move to Egypt and they settle there. And the nation is preserved. And the promise to Abraham moves forward. And the life of Joseph concludes with the nation Israel living in Egypt, just a little pocket of them, that's going to grow into an amazing group of people that eventually will leave Egypt and head back towards the promised land. He's the savior of the nation Israel from starvation, humanly speaking. Does God bring good things out of evil? Is God sovereign? Is he in charge? There's one other statement that I think is so powerful, and I was a little kid when I heard a missionary speak on this verse, and it's been very special ever since. Chapter 49, verse 22, Jacob is about to die, and he calls all the boys in, and he makes a statement about each one of them. And some of the statements aren't that complimentary, let me tell you, because the boys weren't all that complimentary in the way they live. But when he gets to verse 22 and he talks about Joseph, he says, Joseph is a fruitful bough or vine, or maybe literally sun, but it's in the context of a vine that produces. A fruitful vine by a spring, its branches run over a wall. Is that a beautiful picture of Joseph or what? Joseph is like a vine that's tapped into a spring for resources, and it's fruitful because it has everything it needs to not only produce fruit, but it goes over the wall and helps a neighbor. That's Jacob's summary of Joseph's life. And if we want a goal for a summary of our life, that would be a good one to pursue. Well, just a couple thoughts about some principles that I think come out of this. I just mentioned sovereign God is not limited by human choices. If the boys had not hated Joseph and he ended up in Egypt through their deceit and through that whole process, somehow I have absolute confidence that somehow God would have gotten Joseph to where he needed to be and preserved the nation Israel from starvation and extinction. Don't you think so? We don't have to do evil to help God get his work done. But with that, God brings positives out of negatives, and sometimes he seems to use our dumb choices, even our sin, in ways that amaze us. I think that's so exciting. Sovereign God is not limited by human choices. We should not panic when we think something is not working out according to the plan of God. Because, folks, he's got it all figured out, and he's still in charge, and he's still running the show, whether it feels like it or not. And his will be done, and he will accomplish what he set out to do. And those of us who believe him and trust him will have the enjoyment of seeing the finished work and loving him forever. Isn't that exciting? And faith in God is the key to making holy decisions. And Joseph is an example of that. Joseph must have had some pretty good training in those first 17 years about who the Israelites are and what the promise was and what was supposed to happen. And even more important than that, who Creator God is. Because when he's a young man in the presence of somebody who wants to sleep with him, and the guy had to be lonely, and he had no family. And what does he do? He says, I can't do this. It's wrong. It would be wrong to do this to my boss, to your husband, but there's a big issue. I can't do this because it would be sin against God. It's amazing. Powerful stuff. Faith in God is the key to making holy decisions. And much of the time, humans will not see the fulfillment of our faith. Isn't that kind of painful? We want to see it finished. God, I've been praying for this for a long time, and I know you'll do it before I die. And God smiles and says, if you only knew. Joseph said, I'm dying, But eventually you all will be in Egypt. Take my bones. Don't leave them here. Did he see the fulfillment of him saving the nation Israel alive? All they were was a few workers in Egypt. A long ways from a nation occupying and managing the land of promise. But it happened. And probably much of our prayer life and much of our mentoring and modeling and believing and sometimes going through some painful stuff is going to have a result, an impact on people that honors God beyond our lifetime. And that's okay, because it's not about us. It's about God. I always want to pause at the end of a talk about somebody that I think has such an amazing example for us to follow, Joseph, to remember that the potential of us having any usefulness in our life at all, it begins with knowing Jesus. It begins with knowing the Savior. We can live a good life, and we can help a lot of people, and we can be useful in the community, and we can give abundantly for good causes, and people can think of us as the best teacher, the best mentor, whatever we might have been. But if we don't know Jesus, what's the value? We need to believe in our heart, say it with our mouth, Jesus is my God. And though Joseph didn't have the completed picture of Jesus and his death, burial, and resurrection that we have, he had what he needed. He had faith in Creator God that caused him to make holy decisions. And that's what's required of us. And we'll mess up, and we'll make mistakes. And God will use them for his honor. He'll get his work done. Father, I'm so grateful for Joseph. I read these stories of these people in the Old Testament, and they just ooze with principles for life that convict me, that inspire me, but most of all, that point me to a faith in you. To want to believe, and then when I realize I can't do that, then I realize that you give us the faith to believe you and to trust you. So on this day, when we carry with us our heartaches, our worries, hopefully some joys, some anticipations, would you remind each of us that you, the sovereign God, are in charge, and you will bring about what you've determined, either through us or in spite of us. May it be true that you're able to accomplish what you have in mind through us, and always receiving all of the glory and the honor, because it's all about you. Thanks for being our God and our Savior. Amen. Thanks for listening so well.